This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross.
We're going to do this with the most love and respect that we can for the tradition. Let's do this, sucker.
That's Dr. John, the New Orleans singer, musician, composer, and producer, one of the artists to be inducted Monday into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. On today's show, we'll feature interviews with three of them: singer Darlene Love, singer-composer Neil Diamond, and our first guest, Mac Rebenack, otherwise known as Dr. John. Mac Rebenack grew up in New Orleans, but moved to Los Angeles in the mid-60s to create his Dr. John persona. His mentor was Professor Longhair. And as Dr. John the Night Tripper, he led a wild stage production that combined voodoo, psychedelia, and old medicine shows. Dr. John now appears as an occasional guest star on the HBO series Tremé, playing himself and contributing songs to the soundtrack, like this one.
Me got fire, can't put it out. Dream by walk, gon' make you shout. Me got 'em trapped. Me gon' take 'em for a ride. My fly boy just went by. My flag boy is full of fire. My old tribe is having fun. We gon' dance till morning come. Me big chief, me got my band.
When Dr. John began performing as a teenager, he played the clubs with older musicians who promised his parents they'd look out for him. Terry spoke with him in 1986, and he told her what that club scene was like.
Most of the clubs were fronts for something else. It was like the B drinkers and all working prostitution out the backs of the clubs. They all had these motels connected to them. There was gambling going on, like in all these hidden rooms around the clubs. And it was all pretty, what was great about it was it left the club owners to hire bands that played music that they liked. And there was a lot of freedom, so bands in those days did not have to play for the public. They played for club owners that enjoyed music. And what happened, there was a lot of clubs that had bebop music or different forms of music that was great for musicians who weren't under pressure to pack people in a club. Because these guys didn't even care if there was any people necessarily in the club, because that's not where their money was necessarily coming.
There are a lot of knife fights or gun fights at some of the rougher clubs that you played.
Oh, yeah. Some of the joints were real, typical bucket of blood joints. And some of the places that my family knew I was working, and some of them would have just pulled me out the whole scene. I mean, it was nights that guys would push me behind, these one-armed bandits, the little slot machines, and would use them like shields and shove me behind them when they'd see the guns come out and stuff. And, many was the night, that somebody got shot, stabbed, or whatever.
If the guns or the knives were coming out, were you supposed to keep playing?
Yes, we always were instructed to play loud and fast when trouble happened. That was kind of the rule of thumb. When trouble start, you play loud and fast.
What was that supposed to accomplish?
Drown out the trouble.
Oh. Did it work?
Yeah.
So people wouldn't notice that much what was happening?
Yeah, so that the bouncer could clear the people out the place, and usually nobody was the wiser that somebody was murdered or whatever happened. It was usually not even noticed by the bulk of the paying people.
I had read somewhere that you were shot in the fingers, I think, during a club date. What happened? What's the story with that?
Well, I was playing a gig in Jacksonville, Florida, and Ronnie Barron, who was singing with that band at the time, He was like really underage. He was like a couple of years younger than me. And his mother had told me, look, you look out for Ronnie. And I remembered how guys had looked out for me when I was first out there. Well, I went to get Ronnie for a gig. I walk in the room and this guy's pistol whipping him over like a jealous lover scene. And I went to try to get the gun out the guy's hand. And in doing it, I got my finger over the barrel instead of the handle of the gun. And as I hit the guy's hand on a rock to get the gun out of his hand, went off and blew the tip of my finger off. And I was fortunate they were able to sew the tip back on, but it's like affected me from being a guitar player. And it really took a toll. I really feel a lot of the contribution of me getting into drugs was out of connected with this incident, that I was very depressed about not being able to follow my career as a guitarist. And even though I went into playing keyboards and other things that worked out later, there was a long space of time when I was very, like, I had just geared my life to being a guitar player, and all of a sudden that was like gone, and it really messed my whole head up.
How did you start doing studio work?
Well, I hung at the studio, myself and James Booker and several of the musicians. As kids, we just literally hung at the studio hoping somebody would get sick or get hurt and that we'd get the sub for them. And, I mean, literally, we made, you know, novenas to the saints that somebody would get ill, that we'd get a chance to play. And we'd wait. And occasionally, somebody would be late, and we'd get to play for a little bit. And usually, they'd come, and we'd get shooed out again. But slowly but surely, we kind of got accepted into the clique. And it was, like, I think more to do with persistence than talent, you know.
I want to play a recording from your Gumbo album, and it's Those Lonely, Lonely Nights. What did you choose to do this song?
Well, I was looking for some Earl King songs. Earl was one of them. He and Huey Smith were two of the guys that encouraged me to keep on writing songs. And they were like the up-and-coming guys. Like Huey Smith was the young piano player coming up at that time, and Earl King was like called Little Guitar Slim, who was like the hero of the guitars at the time.
And why don't we hear it? You're featured on piano and vocals.
Right.
On this recording of Those Lonely, Lonely Nights from Dr. John Mac Rebinack's album, Gumbo.
There's been some lonely, lonely nights. Oh, baby, yes, since you've been gone. Lay my head on my pillow. Oh, how I cried all night long. The thing you used to say to me.
From this background of playing a music rooted in jazz and blues and early rock and roll, And then you became one of the leading figures in psychedelic music, and you'd created this persona for yourself, the Dr. John persona. How was that created? Was it your idea to do that?
Well, I had always came up with album concepts, and the Dr. John thing was, the idea was at the time there was no real shows that were out around. And the concept was to take all of the tricknology that I knew of show business from over the years, like throwing glitter to make the effect of magic, and using a lot of concepts that were easily and cheaply adaptable to show business and to make a show that would be real mystical in orientation for people. And it was a real, like, easy-to-do show. And all I had to do was to get a group of dancers, and I got all these people from New Orleans who were real familiar with that kind of music. And we did the album, and the show was geared to the snake dancers and all the regular voodoo shows of New Orleans. And unfortunately, when I first presented it, it was a little too authentic for the labels. They weren't quite ready for a guy biting a chicken's head off and stuff. So we modified the show down to a lot less authenticness, to more showbiz style, and took it on the road.
I want to play something from one of your early Dr. John the Night Tripper records, and this is from the Grigri album, and it's Grigri Gumbo Yaya. Do you want to say anything about when you started doing this song and how you'd get into it?
Well, this was the introduction song. Like, on the show, I would step on a button and have a big puff of smoke and say, they call me, and as the smoke cleared, it would look like I had just popped up. You know, it's an old magic trick. And that was like the introduction song to our show. And this also was like introducing myself to the audience as who and what Dr. John is.
They call me Dr. John, known as the Night Tripper. Got my satchel of gris in my hand. Take me tripping up and back down the bayou. I'm the last of the best, they call me the Gris-Gris man. Got many clients, come from miles around, running down my prescription. Got medicine to cure all y'all's ills. I got remedies of every description. I got
Green
now. If you got love troubles, you got a bad woman you can't control, I got just the thing for you. Something called controlling hearts and get-together drops. If you work too hard and you need a little rest, try my Easy Life Rub or put some of my Boss Fix Jazz in your breakfast. Try a little bit of
What was your reaction to the psychedelic music scene? You'd come from a very different background.
I was very turned off by it. Like, even though this became most of the venues that I'd work in later, the whole scene in general, it was like, it was more to me like the vibe of everybody being into the oneness of the planet. Now, that was great, and the vibe, but it was like also used to come in from Louisiana and being very paranoid and very leery of surface things. I felt like, hey, this is something that doesn't sit quite right, and it doesn't feel like there must be some real scurvy thing happening behind the scenes that I was expecting to flounce out at any moment. And then I was watching the after effects of this. I mean, I'd see these runaway kids that would hook up with our band, and like, I was around like the diggers who were like feeding all these runaway kids in the parks, and it was real other side to this coin of all the love and the love beads and all was in the marketplace, but there were kids that out there starving and freezing and not covered and didn't know how to take care of themselves. And it was very fortunate that there were guys like the Diggers and the Panthers feeding these kids and taking care of them.
You were born Roman Catholic. What got you so interested in voodoo?
Well, it's a real heavy part of New Orleans scene. When I was coming up, it was like everybody I know, it's like you automatically, whether it was my grandmother or my grandfather, everybody did certain little gree-gree things. It was like the herbal remedies we took as a kid were strictly gree-gree things. And I don't think people, they look at the spells and the stuff, but that's a side of something, and it's a very small part of what gree-gree is about in Louisiana. And it's just part of the culture.
You were studying to be a priest in the Church of Voodoo and Witchcraft?
Well, what I actually did was legalize it. I chartered it so that the Reverend Mothers in New Orleans would not be busted for fortune-telling, for doing spells, and whatever they did prior to me having got a charter with the state of Louisiana. All these Reverend Mothers, who were some of the best people I ever knew, were getting busted on a regular basis for just going to hospitals and helping people, and it was ridiculous.
Have you been seeing yourself as much of a pianist now as a singer or guitarist or producer or any of the other things that you've done?
Actually, I just have always looked at myself as just a musician. It plays in the rhythm section. I feel very awkward being called a piano player, a something, because what I do is, like, not necessarily, I'm not a great piano player, so to speak. I can play the piano, and I love to play the piano. I love to play music. But I just as much love to play the guitar, the bass, or the drums, or anything else in a rhythm section. And that's really my love. I feel very awkward making piano solo records because there's no interplay. And I always thought of doing something like that as like the end of the rope. From there, I'm stuck with playing the Holiday Inn circuit for the rest of my life, and I'll be in some little club. Somebody drunkenly asking me to play Melancholy Baby or something, and that was my vision of this. Well, it didn't go that way, but that's a real underlying fear with this kind of thing to guys like me who've seen that happen to friends.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed this.
Musician, composer, and performer Mac Rebenack, known to his fans as Dr. John, speaking to Terry Gross in 1986. On Monday, he'll be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. In the second half of the show, we'll hear from two other new inductees, Darlene Love and Neil Diamond. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. We're continuing our salute to some of the artists scheduled to be inducted Monday into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Next is Darlene Love, one of the singers around whom producer Phil Spector built his popular girl group sound. She sang lead on such songs as He's a Rebel, Zippity Doo-Dah, and Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry, and backup on Johnny Angel. She was a singer with a backup group called The Blossoms when she met Phil Spector, but he recorded them under several names, including The Crystals. For years after leaving Spector, Love worked as a backup singer, then moved on to a solo career. Each holiday season, you can see and hear her on David Letterman's CBS show, singing one of her signature songs, Christmas, Baby, Please Come Home. Terry spoke with Darlene Love in 1988. Let's begin with one of Darlene Love's biggest hits, He's a Rebel.
Sleep away, walks down the street. That's the way he shuffles his feet.
I know the first song that you recorded for Spectre was He's a Rebel.
Right.
You sang lead on it.
Yes.
But although you sang lead and the Blossoms backed you up, the song was recorded under the name of the Crystals, which
right.
had already had a few hits, one of the girl groups who had already had a few hits. Why did he record you under the name of the Crystals?
Well, him and the Crystals, I think, had fallen out at that time. They didn't want to fly to California for whatever reasons. Well, he just told them okay, and he just left them in New York. And came out to the coast and decided to record this song because he had in him that this song was going to be such a monstrous hit. He didn't want to sit on it. So he just found the best person he thought he could to do the lead and do the backup and to put the record out, because Vicky Carr had a song, He's a Rebel, out also, and he was trying to beat her record out.
Well, why couldn't he call you Darlene Love and the Blossoms? Why did he call you the Crystals?
Well, at that time, he had the name The Crystals, and he had already had a little success with the name The Crystals already. They already had, I think, like two top 10 or top 20 records. So I guess he figured it would have been easier to break them with another record rather than starting out fresh with a new sound, new voice.
Your recording of He's a Rebel under the name of The Crystals rose to number one on the charts. Well, how did you feel about it? Here it was, your voice, without any credit to you.
I didn't really feel one way about it or the other, because I went in to do it as a recording session, you know, like many of the other things that I did that just weren't hits. Because I did a lot of other things like that, like He's a Rebel. It's just that those things that I did under other names were not hits.
Now, you also recorded He's Sure the Boy I Love under the name of the Crystals.
Right.
Then Phil Spector changed your name to the Bobby Saxon Blue Jeans.
Right.
And under that name you recorded Zippity Doo-Dah and Not Too Young to Get Married. When Phil Spector asked you to record Zippity Doo-Dah, did you think it was a very good idea?
No. I couldn't imagine what we were going to do with Zippity Doo-Dah. Matter of fact, I asked Phil, I said, you mean that song about the Song of the South with Uncle Remus? And he said, yes, that song. I went, well, okay. You have to realize that we were very professional singers at that time at doing background. So when it came time to sing the song Zippity Doo-Dah, we knew the song. And we just kind of fell into the rhythm of the song with the track.
Under the name of Darlene Love, you recorded Today I Met the Boy I'm Gonna Marry and Wait Till My Bobby Gets Home. Did you sing any differently knowing that it was going to be under your name? Did you know it was going to be under your name?
Well, He's Sure the Boy I Love was supposed to be a Darlene Love record, because before we did He's Sure the Boy I Love, we had already became Bobby Sox and the Blue Jeans. We had Zippity Doo-Dah out before He's Sure the Boy I Love, and he had signed Darlene Love. He had changed my name already, and he told me that that was going to be my next release. And I didn't know it wasn't my next release until we were in the car, and I heard it on the radio, and the disc jockey said, this is the Crystals' latest record, and they played He's Sure the Boy I Love. That's when I found out it wasn't a Darlene Love record.
Well, you must have been pretty angry hearing that, huh?
I was a little upset about that one.
Always dreamed the boy I love would come along. And he'd be tall and handsome, rich and strong. Now that boy I love has come to me, but he sure ain't the way I thought he'd be.
You said before that you felt that Spector had you hold back when you were singing.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean?
I have a very powerful voice. Matter of fact, it was funny sometimes when I had to do ad-libs, I would have to stand like, 10 feet away from the mic to do the kind of singing that I did. Or if I would over-sing too much, Phil would take an earlier tape that I had recorded, and use that one rather than the more powerful voice that I was using.
You were known as the best singer in the girl groups. Did you think of yourself that way?
No, I never did. Because during that time, everybody, to me, was almost like sounding alike. My voice stood out in Phil Spector's ears, I think, because I had the more mature voice. And I think that came from the gospel singing, where the other people had not had any kind of professional training or sung in public, where I had been doing that in church and also in school.
Your voice, I think, was not only more mature, it was also more controlled.
Right, exactly. I would agree with that.
Darlene Love, another upcoming inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, speaking to Terry Gross in 1988. Our next guest, and another of Monday's inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, is Neil Diamond. He started out as a songwriter, writing for other artists, including an early number one hit for the Monkees, I'm a Believer. But shortly after that, it was Diamond himself who made most of his songs famous. Songs like Solitary Man, Cherry Cherry, Girl You'll Be a Woman Soon, and Sweet Caroline. Terry Gross spoke with Neil Diamond in 2005. Before we join their conversation, here's a reminder of how infectious his music was. Here's Solitary Man.
The Linda was mine till the time that I found her, holding Jim, loving him. Then Sue came along, loved me strong. That's what I thought, me and Sue, but I do. Don't know that I will, but until I can find me a girl that'll stay and won't play games behind me, then I'll be what I am, a solid.
Neil Diamond. Now, did you write this song for yourself or for somebody else?
No, I wrote this for myself. I had a contract with Jeff and Ellie, and I started to focus in on just what I wanted to do. And so Solitary Man was written for me and for the first sessions that I was to do with Jeff and Ellie.
So how did Solitary Man change your idea of what you wanted from your musical life?
Once I had a chart record of my own, I was no longer a kid knocking around on the streets. I was now, we didn't call them artists at that time. We called them vocalists, but I was a vocalist. And it was a whole different thing. I was writing for myself, so I had to really dig in and write as well as I possibly could. And I have to say, before that time, I don't know if I was doing that. I was just writing and writing and writing, maybe just to get an advance from a publisher. But there was not a lot of me in those songs. And Solitary Man was the first of a long line of me songs, my experience songs.
Now, the Monkees did a couple of your songs, I'm a Believer and A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You. Did you write those with them in mind or for yourself? I'm trying to think of what the chronology was. Like, you start recording in, what, like 67?
66.
66, okay. And what year are the Monkees? Like, is that after that?
I think 67, something like that. I had recorded a couple of songs, including Solitary Man and Cherry Cherry, which was a big hit. And because of that hit, the people who were producing the Monkees called and said, we like Cherry Cherry. Do you have any other songs? I said, well, I don't have anything like Cherry Cherry, but I have an album coming out soon, and I'll send it over and take your pick.
You know, it's funny, the common wisdom goes when telling the story of, like, songwriters from the Brill Building and the Beatles is that the Beatles changed everything. After the Beatles band started writing their own songs, it drove out the professional songwriters. But, of course, the Monkees are a band that's, you know, a kind of fabricated band copying the Beatles. and you have this tremendous success writing for them. And in that sense, like, the Beatles' success inadvertently really helped you as a songwriter.
Oh, yeah, no question about it. But it was not only in the sense of the Monkees doing a couple of songs. It was in the sense that the doors began to open for songwriters who were able to sing. And I just happened to be one of them who'd been knocking around the streets for years and now suddenly was getting a new and fresh listening to my work. So the Beatles made an enormous change, as did Bob Dylan. They brought the songwriter up to the front of the line and said, you know, you guys do it. And it had a devastating effect on the music publishing business in Tin Pan Alley. But it opened up many doors for people like me.
My guest is Neil Diamond. Here's his version of I'm a Believer.
I thought love was only true in fairy tale, meant for someone else but not for me. Love was out to get me, like the way it seemed. Disappointing on good on my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer, not a trace. Doubt my mind, I'm in love, and I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried.
I want to ask you about another of your songs, and this is also an earlier song. It's Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon, and the Urge Overkill version of this was used by Quentin Tarantino in Pulp Fiction. Can you tell us the story behind the song?
Oh, behind the song was pretty basic. I was playing mostly to teenagers, teenage girls, when I first started. And Girl, You'll Be a Woman Soon was something I wrote for them, and I recorded it myself.
How did you find out that Quentin Tarantino was going to use a version of this song for Pulp Fiction?
Well, first they have to request the right to use it. But I got a request and a part of a script to be used in this movie called Pulp Fiction. And I've always held to a very tenuous line as to what I wanted my songs to be used as. And I wouldn't let them be used in cigarette commercials or alcohol commercials. And this script that I read was way out there. It was, beyond what I would turn down normally. And I did turn it down. I heard almost immediately from my publisher who said, you know, you shouldn't turn this down. This guy's a tremendous director, and you should just do it and let them do it, which I did. And, of course, I've never regretted it because it was an entirely different way of seeing that song. But that's basically how it happened.
So what'd you think of the movie?
Oh, I loved the movie. I was amazed by the movie. I've seen it.
How come you loved the movie but didn't love the script? What was different actually seeing it?
Well, I didn't get the whole script. I only got a few pages of the script in which the song would be used. And I don't know if you remember the scene, but she was, Uma Thurman was very heavily into a coke binge, and she went unconscious and had to be taken for some quote-unquote special treatment. You know, it just seemed too strong for my own taste, and I turned it down on that basis.
Mm-hmm. But it was very effective in the film.
It was very effective, and it was a lesson that I learned, you know. See who else is working on it. See how serious they are. Don't take it at face value, and don't take your prejudices into this kind of discussion.
I want to ask you about another song that you wrote and recorded, a big hit for you, Sweet Caroline, which is now played at Red Sox games at Fenway Park, and maybe you know the story of why of why that is. But let's start with the song itself. Is there a story behind the writing of the song?
Yeah, I think so. I was heading down to Memphis for my first recording session down there, and there were some producers I wanted to work with, and I only had two songs written, and in those days, a session was 3 hours, and you usually had three songs that you recorded. So the night before the session at some motel in Memphis, I knocked out this song, Sweet Caroline. It was one of the fastest songs I've ever written, and we recorded it the next day, and it became one of my biggest songs, if not the biggest song.
It's also sung a lot in bars.
Well, the fact is that it's fun and easy to sing with. And I think that that's the bottom line as far as that song is concerned. It's easy to sing. It's fun. People like to sing it. And that's why it's popular in bars, because anybody can sing it, no matter how many drinks you've had.
Well, Neil Diamond, thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry.
Where it began, I can't begin to knowin', but then I know it's growing strong. Wasn't the spring, and spring became the summer. Who'd have believed you'd come along? Hands, touching hands, reaching out, touching me, touching you.
Neil Diamond speaking to Terry Gross in 2005. Neil Diamond, Darlene Love, and Dr. John will all be inducted Monday into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. 70-year-old Abbas Kiarostami is one of the fathers of the new wave of Iranian cinema, winning awards at international festivals for such films as Taste of Cherry and The Wind Will Carry Us. He went to Italy to make his new film, Certified Copy. It opens this week in New York and L.A. and is also available on demand on many cable systems as part of the Sundance Selects series. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Certified Copy is Iranian director Abbas Kiarostami's first film set in Europe and his return to narrative after a decade of experimental and documentary work. But it's anything but simple. It's a mind-bender, a piece of philosophical gamesmanship that can baffle you and psych you out, but also deliver the goods. At first, Kiarostami appears to tell a linear story. Juliette Binoche plays a French woman, an apparently single mother, identified in the credits only as she, who lives in Italy and runs a gallery selling antique sculptures. She has recently met, no, she has apparently recently met, a British author, James Miller, played by opera singer William Schimmel. She's clearly attracted to him, even though she disputes the thesis of his art theory book, also called Certified Copy, which carries the subtitle, Forget the Original, Just Get a Good Copy. His idea, which I'm way simplifying, is that originals are overrated, and widely circulated fakes can lead you to an understanding of the work. He doesn't say how, but that's what the movie attempts to dramatize. The bulk of Certified Copy happens in the course of a day, in which she and James drive to a Tuscan village where many couples come to get married. Car rides are big in Kiarostami's films, and this one is tantalizing. There's something electric between these two. She's nervous and fidgety, laughing to herself at private jokes. James seems rather pretentious, but it should be said, Schimmel, in his non-singing debut, is extraordinarily charismatic, tall and lean and elegantly tousled with the most beautiful baritone speaking voice. They talk of art and forgeries while reflections of the ancient Tuscan buildings slide up and down the windshield. While she drives, she asks him to sign copies of his book, which she says she first encountered with her sister, Marie.
So you see, Marie has... She loves costume jewelry. Well, that explains that. She has very interesting views on things.
Like what?
Oh, those ones, they don't need any dedication, this one. Just sign.
Just the signature.
Yeah, thank you. Like what? Like she says, fake jewelry is just as good as the real thing. You don't have to worry about them. Less hassle, you know, just...
Well, she agrees with me.
What?
She agrees with me about that.
Well, on that particular point, yes, but she's a simple person. She doesn't try to convince anyone. You're determined to try and prove the improvable.
So what you're saying is it's acceptable from her, but unprovable from me, is that it?
It's acceptable from her because she doesn't try to convert anyone. She doesn't make a point. She's just living in her own little world. There's no difference between puppy and original. It's simple as that.
She's lucky. I wish I were more like her.
Like her? What do you mean?
Well, actually, to be honest, I wrote the book partly to convince myself of my own idea. But she seems to believe in it simply and naturally. And I think I envy that.
As the couple's wanderings through the ancient village become oddly tense, there's a complete... I mean absolute change of direction. In a cafe, James tells she a story about the emotional distance he once observed between a mother and small child that seems to be about her and her son, and she cries. Then the old proprietress mistakes them for a long-married couple. Then, slowly, they appear to be a long-married couple. Married 15 years earlier in this very village, that marriage now in the painful throes of dissolution. Most people's response to this jarring discontinuity can be easily summed up. Huh? What? Is this some sixth sense trickery? As the conflict drags on, she speaks in French, James in English, as if only in their native tongues can they reveal their primal selves. Are they really a couple? Or are they play-acting, as if to prove the thesis of James's book? If you're literal-minded, you'll leave Certified Copy in a foul mood, maybe thinking it's a fraud, the emperor's new clothes. But I think great artists earn our leaps of faith. I loved Kiarostami's vision of the fluidity of relationships, even of identities. And while this all sounds rather abstract, what's on screen is tactile and emotional, full of anger, unexpected tenderness, devastating epiphanies. Juliette Binoche is acting a role, which means she's a fake, in the sense that all actors are fakes. But I could swear in those long takes, she was dissolving before our eyes and becoming this woman. Acknowledging its artifice, Certified Copy becomes intensely, miraculously real.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Kevin Griffin, Joyce Lieberman, and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.